Good morning. So last time we were continuing to talk about congestion, and one thing we wanted to think about with congestion kind of was this general dynamics of systems with queues, and there's some sort of mathematical results I've sort of talked about at a relatively high level. And like one of the big things we found out like that way is that because in something like a network, you know, packets don't arrive at time 1, 2, 3, 4, it's like 1.1, 2, 2.5, you know, there's some randomness there, or maybe not really randomness, but effectively randomness. That means that we can't just say, oh, I can handle 1,000 packets a second, so as long as less than 1,000 packets a second are going into my system, it'll be fine. That is not how things work. And we saw that we get this kind of very bad behavior when we're at very high utilization, where basically, you know, randomness means we're gonna have some little burst of packets and some quiet periods, so we won't really achieve, you know, good performance in the sense that we'll have this high latency, high queue lengths, or if we have bounded queues, like in the real world, we'll have lots of packet loss, even though when we look at sort of how much you're using the network, you're not apparently demanding more of the network than kind of its rated capacity. And this is something that, you know, like congestion control is not gonna fix. We looked a little at some modifications to TCP that were done after congestion collapse about sort of setting timeouts more smartly. So we, for the assignment, like you did this sort of moving average of the actual round trip time, and we learned that one of the phenomena of our sort of queue depth kind of changing is that the sort of variation in the queue length changes, and that means that when we have lots of congestion on our network and when we have kind of relatively short, physically short links and therefore low latency from the link itself, we're gonna have a lot of variation in the round trip time, and that kind of guess we did for the assignment of like twice the round trip time is not gonna work out very well. So what they did in TCP is they said, okay, we're gonna measure the variance just like we measured the sort of average round trip time. We're gonna look at what that is empirically and use that to actually set our round trip time, not this times two idea. And they also realized that sometimes when things are real bad, we'll have a whole bunch of connections all sending things from a timeout, and you know, potentially that can overload a very relatively slow network. And so they have this idea of using exponential backup. I suspect, kind of in the reality of TCP, this maybe hasn't had much impact in practice because links have gotten faster. But this idea is going to appear again later on when we talk about wireless, that you know we need to have some way of stopping, you know, what we're doing and slowing down. And we had this in congestion control and lowering our window, but that didn't slow us down when we were resending packets and they were still within our window. And then we talked about explicit congestion notification. So all our congestion control mechanisms were kind of based on this idea that we would lose packets. And this is pretty disappointing from a performance perspective. So, like I've now told you, like two reasons we're never gonna get near 100% utilization. So one is that our queues get really big from this kind of random bursts. And another is that our mechanism for filling the network requires us to have packet loss, which means that we're gonna spend time transmitting stuff that gets lost and we have to retransmit. So that seems rather disappointing. So there's this alternate idea that, you know, maybe we should have some warning from the network before packets get lost. And sort of our concrete implementation of this idea is explicit congestion notification, that when queues are full enough There's various ways we could do this. Routers or switches mark packets as, you know, you're in danger of getting dropped. And maybe if we want to encourage people to use this feature, we might have an idea where we'll drop packets that we can't mark. That if the senders and receiver haven't opted in to using this explicit notification via a bit in the packet, we'll notify them by dropping their packet. And that can incentivize people to opt in. And we saw that this seems like intuitively should be an idea that's like basically just an optimization, because it's better to have a packet marked than dropped. And yeah, there's a cost we're paying. Kind of the cost we're paying is that like we're losing a little bit of our queue length, maybe. But you know, that should be worth it. The actual deployment of this is pretty slow. So this was proposed in 2001, and you know, people are kind of using it today, but like the numbers are not super high. And there were some problems in deploying it. Like there were some networks where you had to not turn on the "I would like to use explicit notification," or they would just drop your packets because they were misconfigured. And there were some networks that just decided that they would strip that out entirely. Even though, like, one of the nice things about explicit congestion notification is that if we have a network from A to B, you know, and our path goes through a whole bunch of, of routers, and say only this one supports marking packets, that should be fine, right? Because the other ones will drop the packets, we'll still pay attention to that, that one will mark them, and that will help us. So it seems like it allows incremental deployment, but in spite of that, there were some networks which decided that they would strip things out, probably because they were doing, you know, network address translation-esque stuff, I hope. Might also be because they have people who have bad ideas about what a security is. And that's kind of the reality of deploying things on the internet, is that random networks will break the thing you thought should just be compatible. So, questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so some logistical things. So for reliable 3, I will supply a reliable 2 solution in Canvas files later today, in case your reliable 2 does not work. And I'll take questions on the assignment. So we had some things with getting VMs working, but it seems like that's resolved, and I don't think the assignment is, I was worried that there would be lots of confusion on, you know, the P4 parts of the assignment. That doesn't seem to be a huge issue. Maybe it's a little too tutorial-ish. But questions on the assignment? Nope, we're all good, okay. At least all good right now. I have office hours tomorrow, so. Okay, so last time we talked about explicit congestion notification as a way of doing sort of congestion control without packet loss. And there's another idea we can have, which is that there's other signals of whether we're at the sort of maximum capacity of a link. And these graphs are how the authors of a congestion control scheme called BBR presented their scheme, and I think give us a good intuition about what we're looking for, is that we can measure kind of the round trip time or the effective bandwidth, and we kind of expect these shapes, that there's this maximum bandwidth that sort of fills the link, and then there's some sort of an extra amount that we can fit in the queue. And when we've just filled the link but we haven't filled the queue, basically our round trip time stays constant because it's just the round trip time of the link itself. The queue is essentially empty. And as we start filling the queue, the round trip timing is going to increase. And our effective bandwidth is going to basically increase until we fill the link capacity, and then it's basically going to stay the same because, well, we're still waiting for that link, we're just buffering more and more packets in the queue. And there's a bunch of congestion control schemes which are based on basically trying to measure where we are on one of these two curves and make adjustments accordingly. And most commonly and sort of most historically, these have used the latency curve, but you can also do the same thing with kind of the effective bandwidth curve. They both give us the same kind of information. So with the latency curve, what we're going to say is, you know, if I know I can get this latency here, and I'm seeing this one, I'm going to say, oh gosh, that's a difference here. That probably means I'm kind of beyond filling the link. And what I can do is I can kind of say, I want to aim for a specific point. Like, I want to aim for here. And I can kind of say, well, that's going to be a certain percentage over the minimum latency. So if I look like, if it looks like I'm too much above the minimum latency, I should lower my sending rate, lower my window size, rather. If it looks like I'm too much below, I should increase it. And we can actually apply the same idea to effective bandwidth. So if I measure that when I'm transmitting at one window size, I get, you know, this bandwidth, and I see this bandwidth at another window size, I know, you know, probably, and I see this bandwidth, I say, okay, well, between here and here, my bandwidth didn't increase when I increased my window size. Therefore, you know, I must be in that high region. I can probably go a little lower. And when I see here, you know, say between here and here, I can say, oh, my bandwidth increased when I increased my window size. I can go a little higher. Now, a tricky thing about doing this in practice is that bandwidth is not an instantaneous measurement. Like, we have to figure out how to average it over time. Other things are happening on the network. So, like, making this work is maybe not so easy because of the realities of, well, my bandwidth measurement has to be an average. How long is it an average over? What happens if my, you know, the link is getting bogged down by other things? But people have tried to make this work. And kind of similar for latency, right? There's other things going on that might change my effective minimum latency. And also, I get all these individual measurements, and probably what I'm going to actually see is not this picture, but I'm going to, like, see a cloud of measurements at a particular window size, and I need to reason about that. So I need to do some sort of averaging, and then there's a question of, like, is that going to mean I'm going to respond too slowly or too quickly to, like, slow changes? But this basic idea is sort of something that some congestion control mechanisms have used, and it has this nice attractiveness that we're getting a lot more information out of the network than any loss-based scheme could give us, right? With loss-based schemes, we're only getting this kind of one bit of information per packet, and if we think about it, we're actually getting a lot less than that, because to actually get, like, one bit out of a packet, we want it to be something like a coin flip whether or not a packet was lost. And that is hopefully not happening, because that would be horrible for our performance. But with this scheme, like, we're kind of getting, you know, a bunch of information, not just yes or no, but also we're getting something that, like, is actually going to vary on a packet by packet basis out of every packet. So it seems like this should be a lot better at reacting to the network conditions versus our loss base, where, you know, we're only going to receive loss signals pretty rarely, you know, in our ideal circumstances. We don't want to operate where half of our packets get lost so we get the most information about the queue capacity from our losses. You want it to be like 0.1%, but that means, you know, we're only going to learn about how loaded the network is every, you know, 1,000-ish packets. So I'll mention sort of two schemes that are kind of in this vein. But basically, the big idea is that fuller queues mean higher latency. Fuller queues means the throughput stays the same as we increase the window size. We can just monitor sort of the actual latency and throughput to detect if queues are too full, and when they are, we can decrease. If they are not too full, we can increase our window size. So same increase-decrease idea, but we're not going to use packet loss anymore. We're going to have this sort of hopefully faster, more reactive signal. And probably the earliest well-known scheme that did this is something known as TCP Vegas. And the way they work is they kind of try to record the base round trip time, and they say, okay, so given our base round trip time, we should get a throughput of one window for that base round trip. And we're going to actually have a slightly higher round trip time than our minimum and get one through that. And that difference kind of tells us where we are on this curve. So Vegas is going to try to figure out where this base point is. And they're going to measure the difference. They're going to measure it in terms of throughput, but it's window per round trip time. And they're going to basically say our ideal throughput is if our round trip time didn't change versus the actual, it's going to be a little slower because we have this queuing. Right, we're not going to actually send a window as fast as our minimum round trip time. And they basically say, if the difference is zero, then you know we are somewhere over here, and that's actually not good. We want to get up to here somehow. So if the difference is zero, we're going to increase it. If it's too large, we're going to decrease our window. So we adjust our window based on that kind of round trip time difference. You know, with the notion that we're measuring, we're, you know, making sure that we send like a full window in a round trip time, and that, you know, we're seeing how much that varies from our minimum possible. And as far as how do we measure the minimum round trip time, our hope is that we get to see that in some of the packets, right? We're going to have lots of round trip time samples. And so what we'll see, you know, is here is like, we'll see a bunch of, we'll see like samples of our round trip time, you know, around here. And the idea is that we like look at the actual minimum number, you know, that happened in recently when we're measuring things, not the average, and that's our minimum base round trip time. So questions about this Vegas, TCP Vegas idea? And I mentioned TCP Vegas is like the earliest sort of well-known scheme of this sort, and probably the most used, not as TCP Vegas directly, but in something called compound TCP, which used to be Windows's default congestion control mechanism. And in compound TCP, they basically took the normal TCP congestion control and TCP Vegas and merged them together. So they have a window size adjustment based on the round trip time and the normal loss-based one, and they combine those two window sizes. Hence the name compound TCP. Yeah, and until Microsoft switched over to CUBIC, you know, less than 10 years ago, this was what Windows would use for about a decade. And I mentioned in giving the motivation that there was BBR was another sort of scheme of this sort. And kind of in contrast to the Vegas scheme, they kind of modeled this as a little state machine where they're going to do little experiments to see what happens if we increase our window size a little bit. What happens if we decrease it? You know, they kind of model this as kind of they're sampling that curve explicitly and like trying to record information about that, rather than the kind of approach we've seen so far, which is that I'm going to have a rule for increase and decrease, here they're going to have kind of make a model, try to basically do something akin to drawing this curve, and then use that information to set the non-experimental window size, and occasionally experiment with other sizes to keep that model up to date. So basically they just kind of observe, they kind of experiment periodically with adjusting the window and see what happens, maintain that model, and try to keep the window size near that boundary based on updating their model of like, what does the curve look like? And I'm mentioning BBR because Google apparently actually deployed this for at least a while. Comes from 2016, so this is actually fairly new. It's not great at fairness with normal TCP. That they said, so like a result says that if you have one BBR connection and 1,000 qubit connection sharing a link, the BBR connection gets 40% of the bandwidth. Which maybe is something they have found a way to adjust, but you know, that's not the best result. Okay, so questions on sort of congestion control things generally, because our next topic is going to be about queues, about other things we can do with things we can do on the switches and routers rather than with congestion control on the ends. Okay, so as I said, we're going to talk about queues, and the big thing we're going to talk about with queues is that we have options in a switch or a router to manage our queues. All of the things we talk about will sometimes be called active queue management. And you might say, what's not active queue management? So this is our passive queue management. And there's kind of two aspects we're going to control in how queues work that are going to make us bring us into this sort of active management regime. And one is the scheduling policy, and one is the drop policy. So the scheduling policy says, which packet do we dequeue when we have a choice? And kind of our default policy is that the newest message is at the end of the queue, and the oldest message in the queue is the one that we send out. And we can call this FIFO, you might hear some other names for it, but first in, first out. That's usually how we expect queues to work. We also have a question of when the queue is full, what packet do we remove from the queue to handle that? And our default policy is known as drop tail. So normally we add messages to the head of the queue going there. When things are completely full, we normally, rather than adding a new slot to the queue, because we can't do that, we've run out of space, we drop the tail from the tail of the queue, which is, you know, the end that packets, you know, and that's furthest away from where things get out of the queue. So this is known as a drop tail policy. And we're going to talk about alternatives to both the default scheduling policy and the default drop policy here, the FIFO scheduling and the drop tail policy. And we can actually manipulate these independently, though we probably want to change them in a way where we're achieving the same goals. And to talk about why would we want to do this, we should talk about things that are not great about FIFO and drop tail. There are some things that are great about FIFO and drop tail. It's really easy to implement. But one thing that's really not great about FIFO is that it doesn't distinguish between flows. Every packet is treated the same, even if some people sending packets are maybe responsible for more of the problems than others. So, for example, if I have two connections going into a switch, one at 7 packets a second, one at 3 packets a second, and the switch can only send out 5 packets a second, then our 7 packet a second one, well, it's going to get 70% of that 5 packets a second and get 3.5 packets a second out. And our bottom one is going to get 1.5 seconds a second out. Why is this? Because if we want to think of what's happening in our queue, assuming that these flows aren't tightly synchronized, if they're kind of a little random, then we're going to basically say have to get rid of 20% of the packets coming in, or more than 20. Is this 20? This is 50. I can't do math. Okay. But basically, the problem is we have 10 packets a second coming in and 5 packets a second coming out. We have to remove 5 packets a second somehow. And the way our FIFO/drop tail is going to do that is if these packets aren't ordered in a particular way, it's basically an even chance that any one packet gets dropped. And that means that we're going to drop half the packets of our 7 packet a second flow and half the packets of our 3. And if we think about what we want to happen here, well, we probably would really if there's nothing to distinguish these two hosts, we probably like to give them each 2.5 packets a second. Meaning that we're going to drop a little bit from the 3 packet a second flow and a lot from the 7. And we're going to first talk about an alternative to our FIFO scheme called fair queuing. And maybe it's really better called fair dequeuing, because that's where we're going to focus our effort, is how do we decide what goes out in what order. So this is going to be a change to our scheduling policy here, that we're not going to do first in, first out. We're going to decide who gets to go based on being fair. And kind of an intuitive notion you might have for this is that if we have our two flows, I have 1, 2, 3, 4. I have 9 packets here. We should kind of alternate them. We should take this one, then this one from our two flows here, the checkerboard flow and the solid flow. We should alternate between them. And this notion, means that, we're going to fairly share between these two flows. And sometimes we're going to have this case where, we don't have enough, of the other flow, and we shouldn't just leave the link idle, right? We don't want to just say, I don't have a checkerboard packet to transmit here. I ran out. I used all 3 of them. Instead, we're just going to transmit something from, someone that's available. So we can say that we're doing what's called round robin here. We're giving each flow a turn, one after the other. We have to keep track of who we're on next. And when that's not happening, we're just going to keep the link busy. And maybe a way that might be easier to view this is we can kind of think of this as we'll have 2 queues, and we will kind of be switching between taking a packet from one and taking a packet from the other to go out to our actual network. That's one way we could actually implement this, is we could have 2 queues and just take from one, take from the other, take from one, take from the other, just alternate. And if we had more than two flows, we do it with, you know, n queues. So this idea is pretty simple and works, but it doesn't deal with some of the realities of our packets. And one of the big ones is that packets have different sizes. So what should I do here to fairly share the network between my solid flow and my checkerboard flow? Any thoughts? Like, what packet should I send first? Yeah. Okay, so your idea is that we're going to switch every certain number of bytes. Okay, so I like that idea. We'll have a refined version of that. But so one idea is that, like, we shouldn't take churns with packets, we should take churns with bytes. And we're going to refine that idea and think about, we should take churns with every single bit, and then we'll figure out, well, wait a moment, we can't actually send each bit visually. But your notion would be that, you know, maybe an approximation would be we like divide up our time into these little slots here. And in the first slot, we'd like send our, I can make this color. We'd send our solid flow first packet here. And then the next slot belongs to the checkerboard one. So we send as many checkerboards once we get there. So, or the wrong color. So we do that. We send this one, probably, and this, and this until we get out of there. So that would be one idea. But this seems a little imprecise because, like, how much overlap we have from these slots, like, seems variable. We're going to have a way of dealing with that a little more precisely. But that's kind of our intuition, is that we don't want to, like, alternate packets. We want to kind of alternate sort of some amount of data. So this is kind of one problem. Another problem is that packets arrive all the time. And so there's a question of, you know, oh, I've started sending, you know, if I'm sending a packet and I receive two other packets in the middle, you know, how do I compensate for that? So in this example, what I end up sending is A1, B1, B2. And this is because, you know, Q had no A's. And now I have two A's to send. When do I send them? Like, do I just, should I do, you know, A2, A3, or should I do A2, B3? What is the right choice? You want to, like, have a way of reasoning about that. Like, what do we do about these packets that arrive late? And it's, like, kind of tricky, right? Because this A3 packet, like, it kind of arrived, it's not that old. Versus the B3 packet's been here forever. Is it like really fair to let it skip the line because A lost a turn? Like, how do we reason about that? So we're going to have a more precise way of doing this accounting that's going to kind of give us an answer to both of these questions. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to imagine that we can do something that we can't really do, which is send the packets one bit at a time. So in our ideal world, we'd be able to send one bit of packets from A, one bit of packets from B, one bit of packets from A, one bit of packets from B. We know we can't do that because we have to send the whole packet together, but we're going to pretend that's something we can do. And you might say, well, why are we going to bother doing this work if we actually definitely cannot do that? And the answer is that we're going to like figure out if we could do this, when would the packets actually arrive? And we're going to work backwards to figure out, well, how can we make them arrive in that order, you know, sending them normally? So let's first do our reasoning about ordering here. So we send, I have these packets to send. So I have a 2-bit packet from A1, a 1-bit packet from A2, a 2-bit packet A3, a 4-bit packet B1, and a 1-bit packet B2. So we have 5 bits of packets from A and B, and I'm going to send 1 bit of A packets, 1 bit of B packets. I've just kind of written down how this works out, just alternating. So step one, I send A1's first bit, then I send, step two, I send B's first bit, then I send A's second bit, B's second bit. And when, you know, I run out of bits in packet A1 and I want to send a bit from A, I just move to packet A2, and so on. And I can look at this and say, okay, well, given that, here's when I finish sending each of the packets. I finish sending A1 at step 3, that's when I send the last bit. I finish sending A2 at step 5, A3 at step 9, finish sending B1 at step 8, and B2 at step 10. Right, so I just did the simulation, I figure out, okay, here's when things actually finish. Sorry, I'm blocking. And we can sort that. And this tells us the order we want to send the packets in. So our goal is going to be to quickly figure out this order and also figure it out kind of dynamically, you know, even as we're receiving packets. So even though we can't send alternating bits, we can definitely send A1, then send A2, then send B1, then send A3, then send B2. And kind of as a preview, when we do that, we'll actually send the packets quicker. Because if I think of, I'm going to send A1, that's going to take 2 steps. If I send A2, that's going to take another step. If I send B1, that's going to take 4 steps. If I send A3, that's going to take 2 steps. And then B1, 9. So these are kind of the actual times I'm going to get. And we can see that we're slightly faster than our alternating bit for some of the packets. And no worse. So questions about how I constructed this ordering. So, yeah, that gives us kind of our actual what we'll end up doing. Now, I address some scenarios that are going to come up that we know exist. And one is that, you know, I mentioned we have this goal here that we, you know, want to always keep the link busy, so we aren't always going to have bits from B, you know, or other flows to send. And we need to take that into account in our calculations. And this seems to make like computing this really annoying. You know, it's kind of straightforward to think about it. Oh, if there's exactly 2 flows, like I'm basically kind of multiplying by 2 somewhere. But, you know, it's going to vary. So, for example, here I have A, B, and C, and I have 3 bits from A, 5 bits from B, and 2 bits from C. These are going to finish at different times, and we're going to kind of have different number of things we're alternating between. You know, so first I send 1 bit from A, B, and C, then I send a second bit from A, B, and C, but then I send a bit from A and B, and then I only have bits from B. So we can still do this work, but it's tricky to think of how do I figure out this sort of a list of finishing times, what I want to actually know, without doing this whole simulation. You know, I wanted this to be something I can implement on a switch where I'm receiving, like, you know, packets, every few microseconds. I don't want to be doing, like, complicated calculations. So I'm going to want some sort of shortcut for this. And to figure out a way of computing this practically, we're going to make this big observation that I can kind of divide time up in a different way than I've done so far. So far, I've kind of counted the number of bits we've sent in total. But when we're sending bits, we're doing these what I'll call rounds. We're sending a bit from each A, B, and C, then another bit from A, B, and C. And I can kind of number the rounds. And within a round, it doesn't really matter whether we send A first or C first. So I don't need to track more detail than that. In fact, you know, like, I kind of arbitrarily put A first, but there's nothing that really said we were supposed to do that. So rather than tracking the step numbers, I'm going to track the round numbers and figure out what round we needed to finish in. And that's what I'm going to compute instead of computing these step numbers. And the reason I'm going to do this is that it's going to be way easier to track round numbers. And yes, like, this makes things ambiguous when they wouldn't be otherwise, but we probably don't really care, right? Because kind of our model is that these should finish within the same bit, effectively. It shouldn't make a difference. Question on how I got these round numbers. So I'm going to have a different name for these rounds, which is going to be a virtual time. So we're going to say that we have a clock, but our clock is going to be the round number. And it's going to advance after every round. And because the number of things we have to send in the round varies, I'm going to call this virtual time, because the speed of that clock is going to change. And that's fine, because it still gives us an order. We only care about the order. We don't care about the clock being at a constant rate. And the reason this is going to work out is that we can quickly compute the virtual time, because how many rounds it takes to send a packet is not dependent on how many other packets there are from other flows. So let's say here I have this list of packets, and I want to figure out when they're sent. And let's say our current virtual time, our current round number, is 0. First, let me look at packet A1, and I'm going to say, okay, A1, it's 2 bits long, it's going to take 2 rounds to send, so its finish time should be round 2. I look at A2, and I say, okay, well, we have to send it after the previous A packet, so its finish time is going to be whatever A1's time plus how long it takes to send it, which is 1 round. And so the key thing here is, because of how I've chosen my virtual time notion, I always know how long it takes to send packets in virtual time units, even though that varies in real time. Then I look at B1, and I correct this slide. So time B1, and remember to correct that for later. And we compute that it takes 4, but we'll finish in round 4, because it's going to be sent simultaneously with A. So we just say, there's no other B packets we have scheduled, so it's the current time plus 4 units. We look at B2, and that's the B1's time plus 1. Because we have to send it after B1, we know it's going to take 1 additional round. And we look at C1. And it's going to be the current time plus 2, because it's going to be set simultaneously starting at round 0. So we kind of have this formula. It's actually pretty simple to compute. We just have to track what round number we're on And for each flow, we want to share evenly what its last virtual time was. And basically what we're going to say is that the virtual time we set for a packet to finish is going to be its time plus its starting time, and its starting time is either the current round or the time of the last packet from the flow, whichever is bigger. Okay. So questions on this algorithm? Yeah?
How do we know when to start counting the virtual time, when to reset it? Because I feel like you could very quickly fill up any size number if you always count the virtual time up and up forever.
So the question is, how do I know what this number, what this value should be, the current virtual time? And that's actually not too bad, because if we've just sent a 1, it must be 2. So we can just look at what packet we're on. That gives us a bound on the virtual time. Now, if we're sending big packets, maybe we want to do something more precise, and there's not amazing answers for that. But the simplest thing is like that this should be updated when we send packets.
I feel like if the switch was just running like open for a long time, that time would pan pretty quickly.
Your question is like, what about like it wrapping around and things like that, or like
if you just leave it open and then it's constantly counting the virtual time as the different connections are sending stuff, then I think that would be seem aggressive to keep using those numbers.
Okay, so your concern is that the virtual time could get too big for us to store. Yeah, so we'll need to do something like wrap around, like we do in TCP, like we did in the reliable assignment to handle that. Just have some way of handling when it gets too big, we go back around to the lowest possible number and do all our comparisons. And that's probably the way you deal with that. An alternative would be you could like renumber everything periodically or something like that, but yeah, you have to deal with this wraps around if we're running forever. Or alternately, you have to have your virtual time use some huge units or some huge numbers to make it so that never happens in a time scale you care about. Yeah?
I was going to ask about the max. So we're keeping track of the current time for like each flow. Are we keeping track of like an overall current time?
Yeah. So the question is, are we keeping track of an overall current time? Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
And the reason we're doing that is because of kind of if a packet arrives late, we usually don't want to give it credit for, you know, the time when they weren't actually sending anything. That, like, let's say this for example, if this C1 packet didn't arrive until after we sent B2, or after we sent B1, that doesn't mean it should get sent before B2. Because if it arrived after we sent B1, that probably means, you know, if we were sharing the link fairly, it would still get sent later because it arrived later, right? It was waiting less time. It wouldn't be, probably we wouldn't consider it fair to give it sort of extra priority because C wasn't using bandwidth. And I say probably because that's not an unreasonable choice, right? It wouldn't be unreasonable to say, hey, if you haven't sent stuff in a while, you get to go faster than you would otherwise. That's not unreasonable to say, but I'm assuming that's not something we're gonna do. If you have nothing in the queue, you start, you know, where you start. You start when your packet's received, not earlier. You don't get a head start. And as I mentioned, this notion kind of can deal with packets arriving late. So that was our second problem. So here I have, you know, what I want to deal with is that, you know, after I start sending B1, you know, I get A2 here. Like, how do I deal with that? I should probably just say between steps 5 and 6, you know. 6 So we have this problem here where I'm going to have, you know, my notion of, you know, the issue I gave you with packets arriving late, which is that, oh, you know, because A2 didn't arrive fast enough, I was sending the B packets first. How do I compensate for that? And this kind of gives us a way to do that. You know, that we send A1 and B1, and we start sending B2, and, you know, we can say, oh, the current time, you know, really should be, oh. And I see I did some bad. Yeah. Really should be based on what arrives. So we can, like, figure out that, yeah, like, because it arrived late, we're going to, like, not give it the full advantage. You know, we're going to let it stand that B got some extra turns. And that's fine. So this gives us kind of our algorithm for dealing with virtual time. So we track basically two things. We track the virtual start time of the current packet, so we have our current time idea. And, you know, maybe adjusted, you know, maybe we could adjust for how long it takes to send, how far into sending it. But that's a detail which I think some implementations might do, but we're not going to care about. And the finish time for the last packet. And basically, we're just going to, you know, compute virtual times as packets come in, and we're going to either order our queue in that way, or at least take things out of our queue based on the computed virtual time for each packet, which means that we have to track also sort of the computed finish time for each packet. And these finish times are always virtual time, you know, and that's why this algorithm is going to be work. So that's a little bookkeeping, and we're going to have an assignment where you do a variation of this. But one thing that's not so great about this is that this says that each of our flows is equal. And, you know, that's kind of intuitively what we're going to do, but that doesn't give us very much flexibility for, like, a system administrator, that we can just make these two things be exactly the same. We can't, like, don't have a knob to twist to say, I want this to have a little more. But there's a simple variation we can use where we, you know, control how much bandwidth it gets. So let's say I want flow A to get 80% of the bandwidth and flow B to get 20. If I was doing my bit-by-bit strategy, there's a simple thing I can do with the bit-by-bit strategy that does this. I'm going to send 4 bits of A alternating with 1 bit of B. That makes sense. So now we need to adapt this to our virtual time algorithm, right? But so if this is sort of what I want to simulate, I'm going to use the same idea of virtual time, figuring out what round am I in. And I just need to adjust my round calculations to take into account that now, you know, A is 4 times as fast. A needs a quarter of the rounds. Well, rather than saying my virtual time is based on your number of bits, now it's based on your number of bits divided by some weight. And a higher weight means you get to go faster. So in this example, we'd say A has a weight of 4, meaning that it gets 4 times as much as a normal flow every round. And so adding these weights, adding this sort of extra tuning knob for our system administrators is actually really simple with this virtual time algorithm. And notably, the weights don't even have to be like integers, right? I could say A gets to send 3.2 bits per round, and B gets to send 1.7, and C gets to send 1. I can do all that, simulate that, even though obviously I can't actually implement something even close to sending 3.2 bits per round. questions on this weighted fair queuing idea? So this idea is like typically variations on this are what you do if you actually want your switch or router to sort of guarantee that multiple users actually get kind of fair use of the bandwidth. And you'll notice like it kind of has nice properties when things are full, and also has this property that like we fill the link if you know there's no activity from the other flows. And we have an upcoming assignment that is going to be implementing weighted fair queuing, also implementing priority-based queuing, which we'll actually talk about later, but that's the simpler part. And in that scheme, one flow gets twice the weight of the other. In the current version that I have posted, there's packet sizes are fixed. I may or may not change that this week because the algorithm is basically the same regardless. And what we're looking for in that assignment is, you know, not that you necessarily perfectly implement all the corner cases of the virtual time, but that when we test two flows, like one actually gets twice the bandwidth of the other in practice. And also, like if there's only one flow, it gets all the bandwidth if, you know, that's available. You know, you don't waste bandwidth on the link. You know, and those are things that should happen if you have any approximately right idea of the virtual time algorithm. We're not going to be picky about, like, how are you dealing with computing the current time? You know, that's not going to matter that much, just the sort of high level. And since we've talked about this, let's do a little exercise to check things. So let's say A gets 3 shares and B gets 1, and we send these packets, what order should they be sent in? We'd like some more time. So someone want to volunteer, what are the first few things we should set? Yeah.
I guess just start by writing down the finish time for each packet.
Okay.
And, well, All 4B is just adding them up on top of each other.
Okay.
So B1 is 500, B2 is 1100, B3 is 1600, B4 is 2000.
Yeah, so we can compute the finish time. So in the case where you get one share, your finish time is just the previous finish time, or the current time, which we'll assume is zero, plus number of bits we're sending.
And for A1 to A5, it's kind of just 666 time 1, time 2, time 3, time 4, time 5.
Okay, so for A, we say that, you know, each 2,000-bit packet contributes 2,000 divided by 3 rounds of time to send. So that gives us 667, 1,300-ish, 2,000, 2,600, 3,200.
And then I guess we just order it by the finish time?
Yeah, and then we're sorting by taking the lowest finish time each time. So first we take B1, which is lowest, then A1 is the next lowest. And then we compare A2 is 1,300, B2 is 1,200. And then A2, then B3, then B4, which is less than, then we have a tie between A3 and B4, so it doesn't really matter for B4, A3. So either order is fine. And then we're going to send A5.
And A4 and A5.
A4 and A5, yeah. And you can see in this example, like, kind of the smaller size of B's packets compensated for getting less shares. And it ended up being almost round robin. So questions on how we figure that out? Okay. So the other scheme we're going to have you implement, which is also something that's sometimes used in routers, is kind of priority based. So the weighted for queuing, like, we're not, you know, is not priority because everyone still gets some share. We can kind of approximate priority. If I give A 1,000 shares and B 1, well, it's almost going to be the same as like giving A total priority over B, but not quite. If we actually do priority, right, let's say in this example, my solid flow has priority over my checkered flow. In that case, you know, if we're dequeuing, we're going to dequeue the packets from the solid flow, regardless of how many checkered flow packets there are. And this is something we can do independently of our drop strategy. We can also use priority to decide what packets to drop. So I can say that if I get a packet from the solid flow, you know, I'll drop a packet from the low priority checkered flow. If I get a packet from the checkered flow, it gets dropped, and I'm going to have this corner case where all my packets in my queue are from the solid flow. In that case, I'll have to have some tiebreaker. Probably I'm just drop tail as my tiebreaker. And another way of looking at this is, and another way you can implement it is, you can imagine this as kind of two splitting up our queue between the low and high priority. Or like treating it as two queues, maybe a variable size, and we always take from the high priority queue if we can. And our priority idea, like, you know, that's different than weighted for queuing. So weighted for queuing, like, if I have 10 times the weight, I get 10 times the bandwidth. With priority queue, if I have one more priority, I get all the bandwidth. So for this reason, like, priority queuing is like, this is a real strategy that you'll use, but, you know, it's a harsh instrument. You know, it's often not what you want to do, and that's why we're talking about weighted for queuing. You know, more often you want something like waiting for a queuing, where you don't like say, you know, if this person's using the network, you lost, which is what priority queue says, but sometimes that's okay, right? So for example, maybe you'll say, the stuff to configure my routers should get high priority, because otherwise the network doesn't work. You know, that might be a reasonable use of this. Okay, so talk about priority for dequeuing and for dropping. So we have now two drop policies. We have the priority-based drop policy and the drop tail policy. And both of these are kind of disappointing. The priority-based one is disappointing, right, because it's very all or nothing. The drop tail one is disappointing for kind of two reasons. So one is that kind of randomly, the flow that's causing the problem will not be the one dropped. And we saw that in our first example, where we had like two flows that both got half the bandwidth, and they also got half of their packets dropped, because kind of the chance of each packet being dropped was the same. And you know, in cases where like our network's overloaded, you know, basically if we think of packets as arriving semi-randomly, each flow will have an even chance of getting its packets dropped. And this is like useful from a sense of, well, if we think about our AIMD fairness proof, we needed that to happen. We needed each flow to get notified. But it's not very fair as far as who's getting punished for overusing this switch. Another issue is that the dropped packet is the last one. And that's actually not great from a point of view of congestion control, because that means that we're going to have to wait 8 packet times to learn that the buffer is full. It actually might be better for us if instead we drop this packet so we learn quickly that we have to lower our sending rate. That's kind of not intuitive, but you know, that's the problem, right? Is that because we're dropping the oldest thing, that means that we're going to wait the maximum amount of time to learn the buffer is full. And so there's this idea that we're going to talk about of early detection, that we want to start dropping packets earlier and drop earlier packets. And their implementation, the sort of most common implementation, is this idea called random early detection. So we want to drop earlier packets. We want to like kind of give an early warning, like ECN. And we want to decide sort of when to drop packets. And we want to do it before the queue gets full. And we don't, because if we just do it when the queue's full, that's going to mean that it's going to take too long to get the signal about when things should end. And sort of the most sort of a big idea that came up for this is to kind of drop some packets early, that we're going to add extra packet drops to our switch deliberately, because it's really bad when we have to wait a whole long time to figure out the buffer is full. That we want the people who are implementing their loss-based congestion control to figure out earlier that the buffer is dangerously close to full and react sooner, rather than waiting for the buffer to actually be full. But we don't just want to like drop the packets when the buffer is half full, because that's equivalent to like having half the buffer size. And it's actually good to have bigger buffers, because that means when there's bursts, like the network performance doesn't disappear. So how can we drop some packets early, but not make it as if we like made our buffer size teeny? And the idea that was come up with this is this idea called random early detection, or RED. And what they do is they like compute how long the queue is, and they randomly drop packets based on that. So our textbook has this sort of graph where you basically say that there's some minimum threshold where you're saying, this queue's getting a little long. And at that threshold, going up to some maximum threshold, you have this increasing probability that an incoming packet will be dropped. And a key thing is that we're going to drop an incoming packet. And this means that sort of fastest time to notify it based on the queue length. And when the queue length starts to get high, we'll start sprinkling in packet loss to all the connections there, and they should slow down a little bit. But we're not going to do it like at the full drop everything rate, you know, which we do above the maximum threshold, the maximum queue size. We're going to do it, you know, we're going to start doing it at a lower rate. So, you know, these big connections that are using lots of bandwidth will start lowering their rate sooner, before everyone's having their packets lost. And a key part of this is that when we measure the queue length, we're going to not use the actual queue length, we're going to use a moving average. Because a big problem with this sort of the naive version of this scheme is that, you know, the queue length can change a bunch, especially if, you know, people are doing things like what some of you did in the reliable assignment of like sending the whole window all at once every time. You know, that can make the queue length jump up and jump down very quickly. And we know that when connections react to packet loss, they're going to do it on a slower time scale. So we want to measure the queue length on that same time scale. So we'll measure a moving average of the queue length, where the idea is, you know, we want to have, no, the queue length is usually this high in the time they can react. We don't want to just say, it just spiked, therefore go right now, because then we'll have like this kind of oscillating queue length behavior. We want to kind of keep the queue length kind of relatively steady. Yeah?
This will slightly reduce the queue capacity, right, in theory. Like, I feel like there's no way.
So the question is, won't this reduce the effective queue capacity? Yeah. It will reduce like how much of the queue we're likely to end up using. But the idea is that, and I guess I can just flip to this slide. So this is from the paper that introduced it. This was their results. And you can see what they said you can achieve is that with the same queue length, you can get a higher utilization of the network. Is the idea, because you're better communicating when flows need to slow down. So like that's the trade-off we're making. But in fact, yeah, we're going to use less of our queue doing this. But that's not a bad thing if we're using less of our queue because people are better managing how much bandwidth they use. Okay, so that's where I'll finish up today, and I hopefully finished up most of the stuff about queuing at the right time. I'll be here for